So from 18th century Venice, we are going to switch now to the 19th century in the United States. I have the pleasure to introduce to you, but I mean, maybe it's a bit unnecessary because he's really well known, Michael Leisure from Pennsylvania University. He studies the visual arts and various media in the 19th and 20th centuries, primarily in the United States. His work is interdisciplinary and strives to understand visual artifacts in relation to contemporary cultural, social, political, and intellectual developments. His book, Looking Askance, Skepticism and American Art from Eakins to Duchamp, published in 2004, traces the interaction between the visual arts and the skeptical forms of seeing engendered in modern life in northeastern American cities between 1869 and 1917. It was awarded the Modernist Studies Association Book Prize in 2005. An earlier book, Reframing Abstract Expressionism, Subjectivity and Painting in the 1940s, from 1993, situates the paintings of Jackson Pollock, Barnett Newman, and others in a culture-wide initiative to reimagine the self in the midst of a traumatic history. It won the Charles Eldridge Prize for Distinguished Scholarship in American Art from the Smithsonian American Art Museum. Michael is currently at work on a book exploring changes in pictorial forms and in social relations associated with the industrialization of picture production and the development of a mass market for images in the mid-19th century. Today, Michael is giving a lecture on how pictures became image culture in the 19th century United States. Welcome.
Thank you, Rosalie. Thank you to the organizers. I, too, am very pleased to be able to present this material to this distinguished and very broad and interesting audience. So thank you, Rachel, Virla, Jennifer, everyone. I'll jump right in. I'm starting by showing you a page from a scrapbook. These are pictures that were collected by someone named Mears, in the 1840s in the United States. So these are the kinds of pictures in circulation that I'll be talking about today. A mass market... Oh, sorry, should I move this closer?
It's too close.
Okay. A mass market for pictures developed rapidly in the United States between about 1830 and 1860. Testimony from period commentators reveals acute awareness of this cultural transformation. Quote, "The illustration mania is upon our people. Nothing but illustrated works are profitable to publishers, while the illustrated magazines and newspapers are in everybody's hands, are vastly popular." That's an 1857 quotation. Few such comments express any surprise at all that pictures should have immediate, strong, and wide appeal. One writer in 1844 voiced what may well have been a widely shared assumption, that people were, quote, just naturally fond of pictures. Looking back from 2016, when most of us are certifiable picture addicts, we may be inclined to sympathize with this assumption. Of course, people deprived of pictures in their daily experience would want them, given availability. But let's pose some broad counterintuitive questions. Why should people unused to pictures want them? What benefits or services did pictures provide across a highly diverse population? And why weren't the poor quality and minimal content of many early mass market pictures obstacles to sales? Some writers at this time were vocal opponents of the permeation of print culture by images. They asserted that the desire for pictures was greatest among those with little education and enthrall to base impulses. Such blockheads, as they called them, lovers of woodblock engravings, were considered oblivious to the constriction of imagination and obstruction of deep thought caused by the intrusion of pictures into texts. The language of even optimistic commentaries oscillates between describing the proliferation of pictures as, on the one hand, a mania, craze, or fever, suggesting irrational, overheated desire on the part of consumers, and on the other hand, flood and deluge, indicating uncontrolled overproduction. In either case, what was called a promiscuous production in the way of pictures was understood to be rooted in some deep and innate iconophilia that education and civilization disciplined. As an art historian interested in social historical interpretation, my inclination is to examine the mass appeal of pictures historically as motivated by particular social groups wanting particular kinds of pictures for rational and irrational reasons under specific historical circumstances. Certainly, the coming of a mass market for pictures was an international phenomenon in the 19th century, and Walter Benjamin has succinctly articulated the key factors. Here's the key quotation. Around the middle of the 19th century, the conditions of artistic production underwent a change. The change consisted in the fact that for the first time, the form of the commodity imposed itself decisively on the work of art, and the form of the masses on its public. So that's the general phenomenon, and I think Benjamin has it absolutely right. It's undoubtedly right. But putting some meat on the bones of this account will require attending to regionally particular conditions and developments. For the newly formed United States, creating a mass audience from the especially diverse and contentious array of social groups with significantly different languages, cultures, interests, and political commitments, who were, incidentally, heading toward a civil war, posed special challenges. So did a widespread commitment among these diverse groups to an anti-elitist, democratic culture and a willingness to let market forces shape the national production of visual and literary art. All of these conditions, I think, predict idiosyncrasies in the United States' path to a mass market for pictures. So given these particular conditions, what kinds of pictures demonstrated mass appeal in the U.S. and why? What combinations of subjects and styles led the way? How was a desire for pictures cultivated by producers? So I've got only 20 minutes, and so I'm going to have to give a schematic and brief account of a very complex story, and several points of that really warrant evidence and argument will have to stand as assertion. What I've been doing in this study, the larger study of which this is a part, I've discerned six or seven tracks along which early mass market pictures in the U.S. took form. And what I'll do today is draw from three or four of them samples that I consider interesting watersheds. I've elected to go for breadth over depth. I think it's more important to give you a sense of the range of purposes that pictures seem to be serving for this mass office audience than to give you any kind of sustained analysis of individual images. Okay, so one track, number one, encompasses political campaign images, and the watershed moment is the 1840 presidential election. The 1840 presidential election, when shrewd tacticians in the Whig Party brilliantly used pictures to mobilize a mass following for William Henry Harrison. This is an image from the Tippecanoe Almanac in 1840. This election marks the first time pictures figured significantly in an American presidential campaign. And those pictures served primarily to fabricate an attractive persona for Harrison that would appeal across social and political boundaries. They also functioned to invest support for Harrison with affect, specifically with a sense of commonality and affiliation based upon shared values and lived experience. Whig managers developed an emblem for the campaign featuring what you see here, a log cabin with a raccoon skin mounted on the side of it. You don't see that here. And a cider barrel, and there it is in the foreground, often supplemented with a portrayal of Harrison plowing a field or welcoming a neighbor or old soldier to his humble homestead. This emblem remade Harrison, a college-educated Virginia aristocrat, whose political campaigns were the same then as they are now. A college-educated Virginia aristocrat whose father was a signer of the Declaration of Independence into an unpretentious neighborly farmer with humble log cabin origins, effectively modeling him on his precursor, Andrew Jackson, whose politics were completely antithetical to Harrison's. This image circulated through every corner of the print culture, including many newspapers that did not normally contain wood engravings. Many of them expanded their purview to celebrate this image, this emblem. But perhaps most effectively, almanacs carried these pictures. I'll show you. Here are three of many more that were focused on the Harrison campaign. Every rural household purchased an almanac annually for its charts showing cycles of the moon, the seasons, times of sunrise and sunset, short generalist interest articles, and predictions about long-term weather patterns. Each was published in an edition of tens of thousands, and they reached every corner of a national population that was only 11% urban in 1840. Harrison's configuration of the log cabin image, presented in a deliberately simple and crude rendering, always in simple and crude renderings, suitable for humble farmers, was an especially effective stimulus to collective fantasy and memory. A fuller accounting would describe how the image, this cabin image, evoked distinctly different meanings for different viewers, and this was an important element in its success. But here, I'll focus on one of the core elements of its appeal. Some of the Harrison almanacs published essays attributing typical effective responses to the cabin images. The almanacs themselves tried to explain why the cabin emblem was being so effective among a mass audience. It was said to remind viewers of a shared past experience that bound them to one another and to Harrison. Those who did not respond in this way, that is, Democrats, were construed as aliens, un-American jeering aristocrats, that's a quotation, detached from the people by class and experience. So in short, I'm going to move quickly through this first example. In short, the popular attraction of the Harrison imagery was the promise of social affiliation it offered, to judge by period comments, and the sense of political influence that came with being part of a dynamic national movement. For a population still having only a vague sense of imagined community, the Harrison bandwagon seemed headed toward national unification and a polity in which the opinions of common people mattered. Owning and absorbing visual emblems of this movement brought aesthetic pleasure to many, irrespective of the crudeness of the pictures. All right, number two. In 1843, a publication that would transform the U.S. print market began to appear. The Harper's Illuminated and New Pictorial Bible, published in 54 installments, like magazine size installments, at 25 cents each over a 3-year period, was credited with initiating the illustration mania that I quoted about just a moment ago. Here's a picture of the Bible and the title page of Genesis on the screen. This Bible demonstrated the ability of electrotyped wood engraving to fill a publication with high-quality images for a modest price. The printmaker, Joseph Alexander Adams, was also an inventor who refined the image technology involved in making this publication to a significant degree. And it set records, records for sales of an illustrated publication, selling well over 100,000 copies from three printings in a 20-year period. Its critical and financial success were rooted in key differences from prior illustrated Bibles. While it contained many formal, technically and artistically ambitious, full and half-page illustrations, somewhat like what you see here, some of these were copied from English precursors also, but about 1,400 of the 1,600 illustrations in the book were thumbnail-size original sketches, designs, by the artist John Gadsby Chapman. And here are two pages showing several of these thumbnail size images. I'll show you some larger versions in a minute. These informal, unpretentious, captivating pictures brought biblical narratives down to earth and fostered imaginative, playful engagement with them. The Psalms in the Old Testament and the Epistles in the New were illustrated almost entirely with these small pictures. Here's one, for example, A Time to Sow. Okay, the sower is releasing his seeds from a vertically raised arm, as you see, and there's no real suggestion of motion, yet the black dots representing the seeds are propelled forward in an arc resembling the tail of a comet. The decision to concentrate new image production on these small illustrations was quite daring, and it seems to have been tested in early fascicles before becoming so dominant later. There are many more in the later contributions to the volume than in the earlier ones. The attractions of such an approach are not hard to see. For an audience largely new to illustrated books, complicated subjects could be unpleasantly challenging. The draftsmen were not skilled at directing viewers' visual attention through management of many compositional elements, so the larger pictures can seem, at times, a wall of non-hierarchical detail. The smaller ones offer clear points of focus and easy comprehension, and many are even playful and foster imaginative reading practices in a book usually treated with utmost solemnity. Here is one of those playful ones where St. Paul is being lowered in a basket. The text describing it is nearby, but the sense of this being almost like a child's game, something that would appeal to a child, I think is striking here. Through these thumbnails, Harper's delivered the Bible to a mass audience in a form that respected prevailing standards of decorum and due formality, and yet provided pictures evidently free of artifice and full of the engaging truth and sweetness of children's illustrations. And I should say that Adams and Chapman, the two men principally responsible for these pictures, had collaborated on several illustrated religious volumes for children in the decade preceding this publication. So once again, different audiences could find different attractions in this imagery. And moreover, the intimacy and familiarity of these pictures brought the Bible into alignment with the Second Great Awakening, a religious movement in the United States that was just at this moment remaking religion into a form more appealing to women and children. So to conclude this part, the Harper's Pictorial Bible attracted a mass market by engaging people of all ages and many religious orientations through humanizing biblical events in a visual language of alluring simplicity and immediacy adapted from illustrated fairy tales. Number three, Jenny Lind was arguably the first celebrity in the United States whose portraits attracted a mass market. Her American tour was orchestrated by the great impresario of early media spectacles, P.T. Barnum, in 1850, and this was certainly a factor in the massive sales of her print and photographic portraits. Now, I would show you a picture of one of these pictures now, but I want to make you wait for a minute so that you can feel the suspense that contemporary viewers would have felt about seeing one of these pictures. How should we account for the pan-national interest in seeing and owning a picture of her face? Her singing voice was said to be exquisite. Barnum advertised that her, quote, her vocal powers have never been approached by any other human being. Nothing extravagant about that praise. It's typical of Barnum. But no such claims were made for her appearance. Her face was routinely described as plain, ordinary, and humble, with a large nose, pudgy cheeks, and a round as opposed to an oval face. She had the appearance, as one commentator said, of a worker like the rest of us. Let's leave it there. But her face was said to register a superior character that any single photograph or print was hard-pressed to capture. Holden's Dollar Magazine said, here she comes. Holden's Dollar Magazine said of the Davignon lithograph, which you see there on the left after the Brady daguerreotype, on which it's based on the right, this is 1850. This lithograph gives an idea of her strength of character, But the enthusiasm, the hearty sympathy, the soul which make the really ordinary face of Jenny Lind a face of extraordinary beauty when lit up from within do not find their expression in this picture." Unquote. Some commentators doubted whether any picture could do her face justice. It might simply be unrepresentable. Here's another quote. "Her living features seem to us illuminated with an expression of honest greatness, sublimely simple and unconscious. And in no picture of her do we see any trace of this. It is a face to our eyes of singular beauty, beauty that goes past one's eyes and is recognized within. And the pictures of her represent the plainness of commonplace girls. Why, a carpenter's estimate with the inches of her nose, cheeks, lips, and eyes, all ciphered up on a shingle, would be as true a likeness of her as most of these engravings. Have we no American artist who can give us Jenny Lind's face with its expressions?" Unquote. So let me show you one more. Actually two more versions of Lind's portraits. The curiosity such commentary generated encouraged viewers to scrutinize all portraits of the singer for one that captured the complex balance of features she was held to display. Passive and active, innocent and shrewd, enterprising and not, true woman and masculine woman, domestic and public. No single image could capture this complex array of qualities that she had to embody. And it seems the cumulative effect of many pictures was what created the image. Not pictures in conflict, but pictures with additive capabilities. This feature supplemented the normal curiosity about celebrities and made Jenny Lind an exceptional case. Finally, a brief word about news images. Again, we might be inclined to think, well, obviously, everyone would want pictures of news stories. And here is one of the earliest mass-circulated news images in the United States, an image of the 1835 New York fire in the New York Herald. And indeed, having seen two devastating fires in Lower Manhattan in 1835, former mayor of New York Philip Hone wrote in his diary, quote, "It was better to see the work of destruction than to hear it described. My fancy is filled with images of horror, which my pen is inadequate to describe." But again, many readers of newspapers did not want fires, shipwrecks, and murders pictured. The Boston Atlas complained about illustrations of a steamship explosion and fire, and writing, quote, "We were sorry to see displayed at the window of a respectable bookstore a picture purporting to represent the burning of the steamer Lexington. One would suppose it was enough to mourn the loss of dear friends without having one's feelings lacerated by an attempt to picture the means of their death." Lawyers for John Colt, accused of murder in a sensational trial, requested that arrest warrants be issued for newspaper editors who had published speculative and sensational pictures of the crime, like this one. So what makes the case of news images so interesting is the fact of their great popularity despite exceptional crudeness and inaccuracy. Let me show you some of those Lexington pictures that were just complained about by the Boston Atlas. This is Nathaniel Currier, who will go on to be one of the great producers of mass market pictures in the 19th century in the United States. Nathaniel Currier's lithographs of the Lexington steamship explosion was published in two very different versions, and you see the two versions. The earlier one is at the top left, the later one at the lower right. And these versions were revised 5 and 7 times respectively over a 2 to 3 week period. The persistent revisions in this instance document the gradual revelation of new information that was also evident in the textual reporting with which these pictures shared pages. Because pictures took longer to prepare and print, pictures lagged behind textual accounts in accuracy. And so note here the switch from the first image, which is shown as a daylight scene, to the second one, which actually registers the fact that it happened at night. There were many other minor refinements that happened along the course of these reproductions. Some of it is also a matter of drama. They've clearly heightened the drama of the explosion and the the excitement, the vitality of the image in the later picture as well. Reception information about these early news images is sketchy at best, but indications are that the issue of precise veridicality, so pressing for 21st century viewers of news images, evidently was not so important for antebellum viewers. Around 1840, emblematic images of news events were evidently as prized as plausible visualizations. The pictures seem to have provided something more basic than an accurate rendering of the scene. They assisted in visualizing the event by providing less salient information, background information, that is, the sort of information necessary to a picture but likely to be overlooked in a textual account of a disaster. The ship's profile, the array of bodies in the water, the range of makeshift flotation devices, the kind of incidental events that a picture provides, those seem to have been the key elements that imaging yielded. Accurate or not, this sort of information, as presented in these images, could provide a visual armature over which relevant details could be layered. Additionally, emblematic renderings of catastrophic events helped keep their shock value within the limits of propriety. So to conclude, the desire for pictures in the early days of mass-produced pictures in the U.S. was implicated in their functioning as, or in their operation as, among other things, emblems that stirred memories and brought a sense of affiliation, both political and national, enticements to playful engagement and intimate identification with esteemed literary texts, models of a human face that registered a vast array of subtle and admirable character traits, and narrative scaffoldings on which accumulating details of news reports could be hung. In all these cases, aesthetic pleasure came not from the elegance of the pictures, but from the associations and memories they triggered for a particular collection of historical subjects. Thank you.